From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
After a 16-year-old murdered my pregnant sister and her husband in suburban Chicago in 1990, I came to understand that the juvenile death penalty, which the state of Illinois tried to pursue for a while, was really not the solution for our society. In fact, children are very, very different. Their brains are not fully formed. They're not making stable decisions. They don't see long-term consequences. They lack impulse control. Executing juveniles in this country is the last thing we need to be doing if we really want to prevent violence in our country.
In a landmark decision on the death penalty, the Supreme Court has abolished the execution of juveniles. We'll speak with a mother whose son was executed and the sister of a murder victim. Then, as the battle over President Bush's judicial nominees reopens in the Senate, we'll speak with Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. We'll also talk to him about restoring ties to the Indonesian military and the 38 towns in Vermont that voted yesterday against war, calling for the Vermont National Guard to be brought home. Vermont has the highest per capita death rate of soldiers in Iraq. But first, a federal appeals court reverses a $54 million verdict against two retired Salvadoran generals accused of torture in their home country two decades ago.
The decision of the 11th Circuit does not change the fact that a jury returned a verdict finding the two ministers of defense of El Salvador liable for the torture of three plaintiffs and awarded them a large settlement.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a landmark decision on the death penalty, the Supreme Court has ruled the execution of child offenders unconstitutional because it amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. The decision throws out the death sentences of 72 juvenile murderers and bars states from seeking to execute minors for future crimes. The United States had been one of a handful of countries in the world that still execute criminals for crimes committed before they turn 18. According to Amnesty International, half of the world's 39 known executions of child offenders since 1990 have occurred here in the United States. Other nations still execute child offenders, including China, Democratic Republic of Congo, Iran, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. For years, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child has prohibited the execution of child offenders, but the United States has not signed the global treaty. The Supreme Court ruling came in a split 5-4 decision. The ruling was hailed by opponents of the death penalty, including Diane Russ Tierney of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
Well, we're pleased. We're pleased that the Supreme Court has said that if you're going to have a death penalty, it has to be reserved for the worst of the worst. The crimes that are the most serious and the people that are the most culpable. And to date, juveniles have been found not to fall into that category. Everybody knows kids are different, and while they should be held accountable for their crimes, the death penalty just isn't appropriate.
We'll have more on that ruling later in the program. In Iraq, a judge anonymously working on the trial of Saddam Hussein has been assassinated along with his son. The pair were shot dead by gunmen outside their home Tuesday. Parwez Mohammed Mahmoud al-Mirani is the first judge serving on the tribunal to be assassinated. His son is an attorney who was also anonymously working on that tribunal. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, at least 13 people have died in a pair of suicide car bombings earlier today. In other news from Iraq, Jordanian militant Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has claimed credit for carrying out Monday's massive car bombing in Hilla that killed 125 people. It was the deadliest attack since the start of the Iraq invasion. The Muslim Scholars Association, an influential Sunni group, denounced the attack. Meanwhile, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting the U.S. Marines have set up a private Iraqi security force called the Iraqi Freedom Guard to fight the Iraqi insurgency. The U.S. is insisting the force is not a private militia, though it's operated separately from the regular Iraqi military. A new State Department report on human rights has accused U.S.-backed Iraqi government of carrying out serious human rights abuses, including torture, illegal detention by police, and forced confessions. Overall, the report criticized other nations for using methods of interrogation that were similar to ones approved by the Bush administration in Iraq and Guantanamo Bay. This includes sleep deprivation for detainees, confining prisoners in contorted positions, stripping and blindfolding them, and threatening them with dogs. In related news, the Republican chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Pat Roberts, is opposing a request to hold a formal inquiry into detainee abuse carried out overseas by the CIA. Democratic Senator John Rockefeller of West Virginia called for an investigation that would reveal the, quote, full facts about the detention, interrogation, and rendition authority and practices used by the government. In news on Syria, the Bush administration for the first time blamed Syria for last week's suicide bombing in Israel that killed five. The accusation comes as Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice joined with France in calling for the immediate withdrawal of Syria's 15,000 troops inside Lebanon. Rice said, quote, "Syrians have a lot to answer for." Meanwhile, Syria's President Bashar al-Assad told Time magazine his country will withdraw its troops from neighboring Lebanon in, quote, the next few months. In Uruguay, Tabaré Vázquez was sworn in Tuesday, becoming the country's first-ever leftist president. Vázquez heads a coalition of socialists, communists, social democrats, and ex-guerrilla leaders. Speaking before the country's Congress, Vázquez said he promised changes and that he will make changes.
Prometimos cambios y haremos cambios, empezando por el gobierno mismo, en su actitud.
Vázquez also vowed to help the country's poor. In one of his first moves, he signed a $100 million anti-poverty program. He also restored diplomatic ties to Cuba and vowed to investigate the widespread disappearances of political opponents during the country's military dictatorship between 1973 and 85. He said, quote, "May the horrors of other eras never be repeated." Vázquez was sworn in surrounded by political allies, including Brazilian President Luis Inácio Lula da Silva, Venezuelan President Hugo Chávez, Argentine President Néstor Kirchner. Cuban President Fidel Castro announced he could not attend because he was still recovering from a recent injury. In news from Afghanistan, the BBC is reporting Afghan President Hamid Karzai has named controversial warlord Abdulrashid Dostum to become the chief of staff to the commander of the armed forces. Dostum is a former leader of the Northern Alliance who's been repeatedly accused of carrying out human rights abuses. In other news, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has postponed a planned visit to Canada. The decision comes just days after the Canadian Prime Minister, Paul Martin, announced his government will not help the U.S. in its missile defense program. Meanwhile, Russia's defense minister said Tuesday Moscow is creating a new nuclear weapon that's being designed to be able to thwart any defense system in the world. Sergei Ivanov said, quote, "There's no defense from these missiles." And the Wall Street Journal's reporting the Justice Department is investigating whether former employees at Halliburton conspired with other companies to rig bids for large overseas construction projects beginning in the early 80s. In addition, federal investigators are trying to determine if Halliburton and other companies had broken antitrust laws. Halliburton recently revealed the investigations and reports filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The American Civil Liberties Union and Human Rights First filed a lawsuit in federal court Tuesday against Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld on behalf of eight men who say they were tortured by U.S. forces in custody in Iraq and Afghanistan. ACLU attorney Lucas Gutentag described the torture allegations.
We have clients, all of whom were in U.S. military custody at the time, who were cut with knives, who were severely beaten, who were sexually abused and humiliated, who were put in excruciating, painful conditions with their arms behind their back, pulled up by chains, something that you expect to see only in a cartoon of torture, who were locked in coffin-like boxes, and who were threatened with mock executions on repeated times.
Also at the news conference, Michael Posner, Executive Director of Human Rights First.
We're here today asking U.S. federal courts for relief for two reasons. The first is to end the practice and policy of torture. The United States was founded on the simple principle that all people, by virtue of their humanity, have inalienable rights under law. Torture and calculated cruelty, inflicted as official policy, the kind of abuses suffered by our clients, cannot be reconciled with this principle. Such conduct strips people of their dignity and deprives them of their humanity. It is the opposite of a regime of rights under law.
That was Human Rights First Michael Posner. Meanwhile, a major court ruling in another high-profile torture lawsuit was in the news this week, a $54.6 million verdict against two retired Salvadoran generals accused of torture in their home country 20 years ago, reversed this week by a federal appeals court. It's the second time the two generals who've been living in Florida since 1989 have prevailed in cases involving human rights violations. In November 2000, a federal jury found Jose Guillermo Garcia and Carlos Eugenio Vides Casanova couldn't be held responsible for the murders of four American church women who were raped and executed by the Salvadoran soldiers in 1980. Jurors concluded the two men didn't have effective control over their own military at the time. But less than 2 years later, another jury found the military commanders were civilly liable under the 91 Torture Victim Protection Act in a lawsuit brought by a church worker, doctor, and professor who fled to the United States after being brutalized by Salvadoran soldiers. That $54 million verdict was reversed Monday when the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta ruled the victims' claims failed to meet a 10-year statute of limitations rule. We're joined on the phone right now by Carlos Maurizio, one of the plaintiffs in the case, a professor at the University of Salvador when he was detained in 1983 and tortured for nearly 2 weeks at the National Police Headquarters. He now teaches biology at Balboa High School in San Francisco. We're also joined by one of the lawyers in the case, Carolyn Patty Blum. She teaches at Columbia University Law School, senior legal advisor at the Center for Justice and Accountability. Carlos Maurizio, we're going to begin with you. Can you tell us what happened to you in 1983 and your response to this ruling?
Well, what happened to me in 1983 that I was kidnapped from my classroom, a special unit of the Army, a death squad came for me in the evening of June 1983. They beat me up when I was in my classroom, took me away. I was blindfolded and handcuffed and took me to a place that I didn't know where I was kept for about 3 weeks. I was tortured in that place. I was blindfolded, so I didn't know who tortured me. But later, the generals, Carlos Eugenio Vides Casanova and Guillermo Garcia, were found responsible for what happened to me, and I truly believe that they were responsible. In a jury made by seven women and three men found them responsible. It was in 2002 in Florida, in West Palm Beach. It was a federal court. The jurors believed that they were responsible, and we agree with them. Everybody agreed with that they were responsible, and the jury found them responsible. That is very important, because Now I've been told that in their appeal, the judges have turned down that situation. But what is important right now is that this is not a final decision, of course. We have to the right to appeal, and we are going to do it. We have 21 days to do it, and we are going to make first for a revision of the decision. This is not a final decision. But what is important right now is that we prove, we did it, that those generals, they are responsible for the torture of 1,000 people in El Salvador and also responsible for the genocide carried out against the Salvadoran population. That is very important. I believe that in the new appeal that we are going to make soon, the case will be in our side again. We are going to win in that case. But as I repeat myself, what is important right now is that we prove that those jury found them responsible. And the appeal that they made is based in a technical situation that doesn't have anything to do with the fact that they were found responsible for a North American jury in 2002.
Carolyn Patty Blum, lawyer at Columbia University Law School. The meaning of the appeals court overturning this, and what are your legal
plans?
Well,
I would echo what Carlos just said in the sense that the decision of the 11th Circuit, United States Court of Appeals, is on a narrow technical legal basis, which is the concept of statute of limitations, and examines in detail when what circumstances exist for tolling or saying that the statute of limitations doesn't apply in a particular situation. It doesn't detract in any way from the findings of the court and of the jury that the generals were legally responsible for the torture of the three plaintiffs in the particular case. And as to the ruling itself, it is a very, very narrow, grudging construction of the circumstances under which the statute of limitations should be told. And one of the things that I find so surprising and really appalling about the decision is that it shows little appreciation for the kind of case that this is. These statutes, the Alien Tort Claims Act, which was just affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court last year, and the Torture Victim Protection Act, are statutes about piercing the veil of secrecy on human rights abuses and ending the impunity of perpetrators. And therefore, the fact that the defendants were at the pinnacle of a system of state repression in El Salvador for the entire decade of the 1980s and depended on lies, deceit, and secrecy to maintain their power and to maintain the repression against the Salvadoran people is clearly a factor that went into why it would have been impossible to bring a case against the generals until they came to the United States and a period of time had passed after peace had been achieved in El Salvador.
Carolyn Patty Blum and Carlos Maurizio, I want to thank you very much for being with us. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be speaking with Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont and also find out about the 38 Vermont towns that have voted against war, calling for the Vermont National Guard to be brought home. We'll speak with the organizer of the campaign of resolutions. Stay with us. Snow by the Grateful Dead. In a moment, we'll be joined by Vermont's Deadhead Senator Patrick Leahy. The battle over President Bush's judicial nominees reopened reopened today, and it is a very serious issue in the Senate yesterday. For the second time in 2 years, appellate court nominee William Myers faced questions from the Judiciary Committee about his record as the Interior Department's top lawyer and a lobbyist for mining and cattle interests. The impasse over judges is one of the most explosive issues facing the 109th Congress. Myers is the first test case. He's one of seven appellate court nominees blocked by Democratic filibusters and Bush's first term, but resubmitted by the president this year. Three other blocked nominees were withdrawn. We're joined by Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont. He's the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Joins us on the line from Virginia. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us.
I was interested in your choice of music leading into the segment.
I understood you wanted us to just continue with the music in this new show.
That's all right. I know that one very well.
Can you respond to, can you explain who the people are that President Bush has now renominated?
Sure. This thing has become so hyped and so misunderstood. President Bush has actually done very well with his judicial nominees with Democratic help. And those that have been consensus nominees, they've gone right through. For example, during the 48 months of his term, the Democrats were in charge of the Senate for 17 months. During that 17 months, we confirmed 100 of his judges. In the remaining 31 months, the Republicans confirmed another 103. We actually moved a lot faster for President Bush than his own party did. But some go beyond the pale. I mean, he's sent up one man who's we blocked is back again, who practiced law illegally in two jurisdictions for years. First in the District of Columbia, and then he practiced illegally, and then moved to Utah and practiced illegally. He's been now nominated for the second highest court in the land. Can you imagine if Bill Clinton had done that? There'd be screaming headlines on it. Another is a judge who has ruled so consistently with basically the financial interest. I'll give you one example. A woman had sued. Turned out that she was many women who were in for physical exams, in this case a breast exam, and the doctor brings in a salesman and just puts a white coat on them so they can watch the exam. When she sues, the judge rules, well, she shouldn't have had any sense of a right of privacy. Well, you assume if you're in that kind of a situation, you're being examined by somebody in a white coat, that they are a doctor. And this, now we had yesterday a lawyer who involved not only in substantial conflicts of interest, but people that he placed in the Department of Interior continue those conflicts of interest. As I said in his hearings, he said that he considers the environmental arm of our government, the tyranny of King George. I reminded him that I was born and raised in the part of America that fought the revolution against King George, and that we don't consider our government that tyrannical. I mean, these people go beyond the mainstream. Now, I mentioned before how we moved 100 of his judges in 17 months. We did this even though we had 61 of President Clinton's judges subject to these kind of pocket filibusters by the Republicans. They never allowed them to come to a vote. 61, almost all of whom would have been confirmed had they come to a vote. We tried to change that by moving the presidents, but we've also told the president, this is an independent branch of government, the judiciary is. you cannot put people on there who, in a way that you're going to try to make the judiciary an arm of the Republican Party, actually an arm of the most conservative part of the Republican Party. I wouldn't allow it if a Democrat wanted to make the judiciary an arm of the Democratic Party. It has to be an independent judiciary or it loses all its credibility.
We're talking to Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy about President Bush's judicial re-nominees, among them William Pryor and Priscilla Owen. Can you talk about these two judicial nominees, Senator Leahy?
Well, I felt that Priscilla Owen from Texas is so far out of the mainstream. Her opinions, even the very conservative Texas Supreme Court, has criticized her as being out of the mainstream. If we're going to have positions filled, especially when...
In what way, specifically?
Well, just it is almost a knee-jerk reaction. Corporations can do no wrong. People who have been injured have no real cause of action. I mean, it's so much over and over and over again. You read her... I give you an idea. We had two or three senators who had met with her, were very predisposed toward it, and then started reading her decisions and said, how can somebody be this blind to what is happening to people? Now, Mr. Pryor was sent up. Actually, he's on the bench now because he's given a recess appointment. He was sent up, and it was made very, very clear he was there simply as a symbol. Now, he's a nice enough person. I've met him. He's a pleasant person, all that, but sent as a symbol and packaged by the White House in a way that we want to have a symbolic, ideological position on this independent court. I mean, that almost guaranteed there'd be opposition. We'll go back now. He's been on the court for a few months. We'll go and look at the decisions he's written since he's been there.
So this issue of if you filibuster, and I want to ask if you plan to, Senator Frist saying using the nuclear option, the whole idea of ending filibuster.
Well, of course, that would so change the whole nature of the Senate. The Senate is unique. And the founders of this country set it up to be unique so that every state has a voice, no matter its size, and so that things can be slowed up so that the passions of the moment can be slowed up. It's sort of like Jefferson's saucer, as he referred to it. So the Senate can look at things more carefully. We have things that pass sometimes in a spur of the moment from the House of Representatives because it's emotional and so on, fully expecting the Senate to take some time to look at it. Now, sometimes we take too long. Most of the time we get it very right. If you want to do away with the ability to slow things up, what you say is you might as well just do away with the Senate. Let's have an arbitrary executive. If they have their own party in power, just do anything they want. It would also mean that almost half the states in the country would have no voice. On a more practical matter, of course, 90% of what's done in the Senate requires a unanimous consent. If people stopped doing that, the whole Senate would come to a screeching halt. It's a dumb idea. It's a dumb idea.
Senator Leahy, I wanted to get to two other issues before.
Sure.
I know you have to go. One of them is IMET. One of them is Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, calling for the restoration of international military education and training aid to Indonesia. Restoring military ties with the Indonesian military, which were cut off after the Santa Cruz massacre in 1991, in which the Indonesian military killed more than 270 Timorese, and ultimately cut off in 1999 as the people of Timor voted for independence and Indonesian military razed the country to the ground. Now Condoleezza Rice saying that they're going to restore. You have been very active on this issue over the past decade. What is your response?
Well, you are one of the most knowledgeable people in the media about the situation in Indonesia and Timor from your own experience there. And I told Secretary Rice I see no reason to be rewarding the Indonesians with this IMED program. It's not a great deal of money. They want it for more for the symbolic. But they have we've had Americans murdered there, aside from all the people in that region, the Timorese and others who have been murdered, and nothing's been done. I mean, if we just want to look at it from a purely selfish point of view, we've had Americans been murdered. You have a person who has admitted complicity in the murder, and we can't get them even turned over to us. Why in heaven's name we are rewarding? This is supposed to be a law and order administration. Heck, I was a prosecutor. I wouldn't be rewarding somebody who was holding a murderer that I wanted to get. Mr. Wamang, the one person indicted in the U.S., why hasn't he been indicted and arrested there?
So what are you going to do about...
Well, I think that I think I'm going to keep pushing it. I think it was a bad, bad mistake on the part of the administration. I think it's almost saying, here, you can thumb your nose at us. I'd be amazed that they would do a thing to help us out. And what unless there is an amazing change in it, I'm simply going to bring up the amendment again in the next appropriations bill. I think this is the Indonesians have spent millions of dollars trying to get these few hundred thousands of dollars because of the symbolic effect. My response to that would be, if you want the symbolism, then do the substance. Turn over the people that murdered the Americans. Clean up your own house within the military. I think the police and others are moving better. The military certainly have not.
Senator Leahy, finally, in your home state of Vermont, 38 town meetings voted yesterday to condemn the war in Iraq, calling for Vermont National Guard to be brought home. Vermont has the has lost more soldiers per capita in Iraq than any other state. Would you call for these soldiers to be brought home, the Vermont National Guard?
We're a feisty state. We will do what we are called upon. I mean, our National Guard and our the leaders of our National Guard have said that. I think the war was a mistake. I think we're stretching the Guard far too thin. I'm very, very proud of the men and women in our state who have answered. I hope we can get them back as soon as possible. I hope we can get back all the Guard and Reserves from all the states as soon as possible.
And what about the significance of this number of towns?
I want to see. I understand the resolution. I'm just getting some of the press stuff this morning. I understand the resolution was varied considerably in some towns. Some towns are lost. One town I think it tied. Others it passed overwhelmingly.
Right, in 38 of the 50 town meetings where it was brought up,
yeah,
it passed.
And I don't know what part of the population that's a small part of the population involved. We have almost 260 towns, but of varying sizes, from 38 people to 38,000. And I will look at it. I think the people in Vermont know my strong opposition to the war. They know I want to get these soldiers back, but I want to get them back from all the states.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, speaking to us from Virginia. Thanks for joining us. As we turn now to Ben Scotch in Vermont, who is the person who organized the Iraq Resolution campaign. Last night, again, those 38 town meetings voting to condemn war in Iraq and calling on political leaders to bring home the state's National Guard. Vermont losing more soldiers per capita than any other state, has the second highest mobilization rate for its National Guard and reservists. Ben Scotch, you helped organize this resolution. Talk about how it all began.
Amy, it all began with a rally against the war shortly after the election. And Montpelier and the rest of Vermont have seen a good number of rallies, and they're very spirited. But the organizers of the rally got together after, and they said, what more can we do? We need to rally, but we also need to speak. And it became clear that the right place to speak was town meeting. That's been a tradition well over 200 years here in Vermont. And we got busy collectively as a team. We drafted a resolution. We redrafted it. It went through 19 different versions. We then circulated it to the towns. I'm happy to say, Amy, that by midnight, we had 48 and not 38 towns, if you don't mind a very minor correction. We had 48 towns adopting resolutions that were very close to each other in text. There were some variations. We had three towns that voted it down and just three towns that tabled it. We think that's really an overwhelming signal to the nation.
And on this issue of calling the Vermont National Guard home, who suffered the worst casualties in any state per capita, what exactly are you calling for in this resolution?
Well, let me really summarize the resolution and hit its main points. I think I can reduce that to just 4 points. The resolutions, every single one, and it got up to 56, more than 52, every single resolution begins with a plea to support and respect the troops. We need these people here. They're first responders, their family, their friends, their workers down the street. They make up the fabric of society in Vermont. They're an important part of that fabric. So we began with that. And, Amy, it wasn't just lip service, as some have suggested. The rest of the resolution also supports members of the Guard. But let me just give you the high points of what we asked for. We asked for our legislature to assess the impact of the deployment, not just on readiness, but on our communities, on our families. We're asking the delegation, Senator Leahy, Senator Jeffords, Congressman Sanders, to help restore a reasonable balance between states and the federal government, not in the case of every war, only in what we call wars of choice. We know that if this country is attacked, if there's an emergency, if there's an insurrection under the Constitution, there is no question that Guard members have signed up to serve and that they would serve and they would serve with enthusiasm and a sense of duty. Wars of choice are a whole different phenomenon. They're relatively new. We have no national policy governing the use of these wars, and it's a big omission.
Ben Scotch, on that point, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Ben Scotch is one of the people who organized the Vermont Resolution campaign, now learning that 48 of the 50 town meetings in Vermont yesterday voted to condemn the Iraq War, beginning to call for the Vermont National Guard to be brought home. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about the precedent-setting decision of the Supreme Court yesterday abolishing the death penalty for juveniles. Stay with us. Freedom by the New Process here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 300 Pacifica NPR public access TV PBS stations, as well as on both Dish Network, on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV, Channel 375. We video and audio stream at democracynow.org and our closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing on our TV broadcasts. I'm Amy Goodman. In a 5-4 ruling yesterday, the Supreme Court abolished the death penalty for juveniles. The historic decision came in the Roper v. Simmons case out of Missouri, which involved Christopher Simmons, 17, in 1993, tied up a woman, threw her from a bridge to her death. The Supreme Court decision overturned his death sentence, declaring that the execution of juveniles violates the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. The decision could affect more than 70 death row prisoners who face execution for murders done when they were 16 or 17 years old. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion for the majority. Chief Justice William Rehnquist and Justices Sandra Day O'Connor, Antonin Scalia, Clarence Thomas dissented. In an unusual move, the Supreme Court ruling cited the overwhelming weight of international opinion in banning executions of those under 18. Justice Kennedy noted the U.S. was the only country in the world that still officially permits execution of juveniles. He wrote, since 1990, only 7 countries have executed people under 18. In Iran, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and China. However, all of these countries have since publicly disavowed the practice. Justice Kennedy also noted the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which prohibits the juvenile death penalty, has been ratified by every country except Somalia and the United States. But fellow Justice Antonin Scalia assailed Kennedy's argument. Scalia took the unusual step of reading his 24-page dissent from the bench. He accused the court of, quote, proclaiming itself sole arbiter of our nation's moral standards. Scalia disputed the notion that a national consensus on the juvenile death penalty has emerged and warned about taking into account international opinion. Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist and Justice Clarence Thomas signed on to Scalia's dissent. Justice Sandra O'Connor issued a separate dissenting argument. We are now joined today by Rena Beasley. Her son Napoleon Beasley was executed when he was 17 in Texas in 2002. She joins us on the phone from Grapeland, Texas. We're also joined from Illinois by Jennifer Bishop. She's the founding member of Murder Victims Families for Human Rights. She lost her pregnant sister as well as her brother-in-law. They were murdered. She speaks out against the death penalty. And in Washington, D.C., in studio, Jataka Edey, domestic program coordinator for the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. First, I wanted to turn to Rena Beasley, mother of Napoleon Beasley, killed in 2002. He was executed when he was 17. Can you talk about the ruling?
Well, Napoleon was sentenced to death in 1994 on the day of his execution. We all know that Simmons' execution was upheld, and he was allowed to live. And based on, they were waiting for the ruling from the Atkins case. And, of course, Napoleon's stay was denied, and he was executed May 28th of 2002.
How old was he when he was executed?
He was 25 at the time of execution.
25. 17 when he committed the crime.
17 when he committed the crime.
So if the decision had come down 2 years ago from the Supreme Court, he would not have died.
Correct.
Your reaction?
Ma'am?
Your reaction?
Bittersweet, happy for the 70 other families that's been affected by the bill, yet upset at the fact that we lost out and Napoleon's life was taken away. Napoleon had all the qualities that should have allowed him to live. He had no history of violence. He was one of the tops in his class. He was class president. He was athletic. He was just an all-around good kid. Yet, you know, he was sentenced to death, and the death penalty should be reserved for the worst of the worst, and that was not Napoleon. If the governor had issued a stay today, Napoleon would have been alive.
You don't deny he committed the murder?
He didn't deny. We don't deny it.
And the reason you feel that the death penalty was inappropriate, the circumstances? Or are you opposed to the death penalty overall?
Not overall. I don't want their blood on my hands. You know, I don't want to be the one to say somebody has to die. But in the case of a serial killer, there are instances where I could just look the other way. But for a 17-year-old and under, based on all the things that Kennedy said, I agree with. They don't have, they're immature. They don't think about the consequences. They've been under the care of their parents all their lives, never left the household of their parents. And then they go and they mess up. And I just think the death penalty should be reserved for the worst of the worst, if we're going to have the death penalty.
We're also joined by Jennifer Bishop. You lost your sister-in-law, your sister, who was pregnant, your sister's husband, 1990. They were murdered. Can you talk about their case and why you still oppose the death penalty?
Yes. My sister was murdered by a 16-year-old in suburban Chicago. And there was a move in Illinois to start a juvenile death penalty here after her murder. And let me just say that, you know, as a murder victim's family member, I also, my heart just goes out this morning to the Beasley family and to others like them, because I think that we have come to a place as a nation that we realize that killing children is not the solution to the violence problem in our country. And there isn't a deterrent value. We're talking about, you know, new evidence. And, of course, I knew this from the time we found out this 16-year-old brutally murdered my pregnant sister and her husband, that, you know, that there's something wrong with impulse control, that there is judgment questions. We have brain research that shows the frontal lobe not fully formed until their 20s. You know, we know every parent has known from time immemorial that kids this age are not capable of the same kind of sound reasoning and judgment that adults are capable of. And so I think it's really good the court has recognized this. I know that in my case, killing more children is a response to the horrific things that have happened to us is not the solution. It doesn't deter. It doesn't save us anything in terms of public safety. It does not really make us a safer or better people. In fact, how we treat those among us that are the worst of the worst is really how we are judged as individuals and as a society. And to execute children when there is redemption possible and when there are opportunities to rehabilitate them, this is just a real, I'm glad as a nation, very, very glad this morning that we've abolished this practice.
Jotaki Edey joining us in Washington, National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Your response?
I think yesterday was a very historic moment for all of us that are doing work. I've been working so long against the death penalty, and we're just so pleased, our organization, the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, as well as many of the other organizations and activists and advocates out there who are opposed to this practice, that the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized that kids are different. They have recognized that we have evolved as a world, we have evolved as a society, and that the execution and the imposition of the death penalty on children, we're talking about 16 and 17-year-olds, is barbaric, and it's a human rights violation. And I think you echoed at the beginning of this segment a lot of attention paid to the international community, international law. The United States was alone in this practice. I think also what was very important is that we had a national consensus, and Justice Kennedy noted that we had a national consensus in the number of states that had changed their laws, who had debated this in their state legislatures, that found that we no longer needed this practice. There was public opinion in numerous child welfare groups, and other groups that aren't necessarily totally opposed to the death penalty, that are opposed to the imposition of the death penalty on juvenile offenders. So we really reached that moment in this country, a national consensus, and we're so pleased that the Supreme Court has recognized that.
The significance, now we're talking about state law because the federal death penalty did not apply to juveniles. And Scott McClellan, President Bush's press secretary, said Bush has no plans to change the federal law. So we're just talking about the state laws, but that is very significant. Does this mean now that's it? Absolutely every person who committed a crime before they were 18 will be taken off of death row as of today?
Yes, there is definitely going to be some movement in the states. Some of the states, as you know, they're right now, and including Missouri, it's 31 states that prohibit the practice. But we're going to see a lot of the states are going to have to change their statutes and their codes to reflect the opinion of the Supreme Court that we saw on yesterday.
Can you talk about this idea of the judge bringing in the issue of international opinion here in weighing in, saying that it helped to shape his decision?
I think that we've seen this before. We saw that with Atkins v. Virginia, which was the case that involved the death penalty for those suffering from mental retardation, which we saw in 2002, where the Supreme Court barred and prohibited, found that unconstitutional. And we've seen that in some other cases. But clearly, the world opinion is very important, international law. The United States was the only country in the world that was actively and legally executing and imposing the death penalty on persons under the age of 18. The rest of the world had moved away from this practice. It's been a dramatic move from the rest of the world, violating several international covenants and instruments, including, as we saw in the opinion, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, several UN Human Rights Commission resolutions, as well as other international covenants. It was basically it had risen to a level where it was just international norm not to execute persons that are under the age of 18. And so I think the justices recognize this. And I think it's important that we recognize that we're part of a global community and that this is one of a very gross violation of human rights in this country. And I think the court is recognizing this. And it's good to note that Justice Kennedy said it wasn't necessarily controlling, but we are part of a global community and we have to look at and recognize that we were violating a fundamental right that the rest of the world had recognized. And so I think it's important that we look at human rights as we're shaping the laws in our country.
Chitaka, this doesn't relate to juvenile death penalty, but also yesterday, the Republican-controlled New York Senate in Albany announced it'll pass legislation next week to reinstate the death penalty. 8 months ago, New York's highest court struck down the death penalty after determining jury instruction provisions would cause some jurors to vote for death when they really didn't want to. But now they're saying they're going to reinstate it. Your response?
I mean, I think, and it's important to know that in New York, there's a large majority of activists and citizens and New Yorkers that are opposed to the death penalty. I'm sure many people are aware of the large numbers of people that came out to testify against reinstating the death penalty in New York. I think what's important is that we recognize a large number of people that came out in opposition to this. I think that the battle is not necessarily lost in New York, but I think it's important to see that we are moving along and moving forward in this fight against the death penalty overall. We've seen those that are suffering mental retardation barred from the death penalty. Yesterday, we saw juvenile offenders removed off of death row. And we're also seeing in different states, like in New York, as you spoke of, we saw where it was struck unconstitutional in New York. And we also seeing the same thing in Kansas. And there are a number of states that are weighing moratorium legislation. So
also,
we're moving forward.
Also in this week, New Mexico House voted to abolish the death penalty. Jennifer Bishop, do you see what the Supreme Court decided, the striking down of death penalty for juveniles? Do you see it as part of a continuum? Do you think that the death penalty will be abolished in this country, Jennifer?
And it's because, it's not because, you know, other people are telling us to do. I think the court is recognizing that that the international opinion affirms what they themselves are seeing here. So I don't think that that's necessarily because the outside community is telling us that, although I do think that that does tell us something that we are behind on. But I do think that the nation is going to come to recognize more and more that it doesn't help victims. I mean, I'm absolute testimony to that. It does not make victims feel better. It doesn't save us money. It doesn't deter crime. It doesn't help to show that killing is wrong. It doesn't reduce violence. In fact, there seems to be a clear relationship that there's more violence in states where there are a lot of executions. We have to, as a society, stand up in our laws and say, the killing is wrong. I've experienced it firsthand, and I'm telling you as a murder victim's family members that, you know, we know how wrong it is to kill, and we as a nation cannot kill those who are killing in order to show that it is wrong. We have to stop and look instead with our resources and our time and our money at ways we can prevent the violence. We need to look into crime prevention programs, and we need to look at mental health issues, and we need to work in community policing and in other areas that are going to really fight the crime and prevent the violence rather than to replicate the very act which we are trying to oppose.
Jennifer Bishop, Rena Beasley, and Jotaka Edie, I want to thank you all for being with us. Your websites will be at our website at democracynow.org. And finally, in other Supreme Court news, the High Court will hear arguments today on whether the Ten Commandments can be legally displayed on government property. At issue is whether public displays of the Ten Commandments violate the First Amendment ban on any law respecting an establishment of religion. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Headed to Madison, Wisconsin on Saturday. On Friday, we'll be in Denver. And next week on March 10th in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan. That does it for our show. You can go to our website for more details. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.